we are on the bottom of page 9, according to my notes. So last time we finished up the time in Lystra and the suffering which Paul experienced. We also talked about and I gave you the chart there from Craig Keener's commentary on the book of Acts, comparing how Luke records Peter's first healing and Paul's first healing. You know, Luke's got a lot of things going on as he's writing to Theophilus, a lot of things. He's not just giving us history, right? The book of Acts is not mere history. He's giving us, obviously, lots of theology. He's also giving to us transitions from Peter's ministry to the Jews, Paul's ministry to the Gentiles, right? He's given us all of that and showing the similarities and the distinctions, the differences. He leaves us without certain information that we would like to know, and yet he gives us much information that we absolutely need to know. And part of that is here now in verses 21 through 23. But before we do that, I should ask, you've had time to think about what we looked at last week. Were there any questions or observations? All right, so let's go to Derby. All right. The end of verse 20 says, "The next day he went away with Barnabas to Derby." Now, he's just been stoned, right? So that's got to be in your mind of how long is this going to take, right? My guess is he's limping a little bit, maybe. You know, talk about some sore muscles, right? Like, ooh, you know, that sort of thing, and you're walking. Maybe they hired an animal to carry him. Maybe they hired, what do you call those? Pala, where they carry the four guys carry the guy on the, is that a palanquin? Is that what that's called? Anyway, the point is, you know, it's not an ambulance, you know. However they get him there, that's to me is just one of those things that he doesn't tell us, right? He's just, but we have to keep that in mind, that Paul has just been stoned. They assumed him to be dead, and the next day he starts walking this roughly 60 miles, right? And there's days you get out of bed and you're thinking, I'm not going to go for that walk, right? You just, you know, and then Paul has, you know, again, the even if it is 35, 40 miles, right, that's still to Redwood Falls plus, right? And after you've been stoned, wow. So as I've said there, it puts him now roughly 150 miles from his hometown. Again, is he familiar with this? We don't know. Is he familiar with Derby? We do know that Gaius is from this hometown. We'll see him later on. So some of these names Luke is introducing to us, and we'll see them later in some of the epistles, right? So just those are things to keep in mind. So it says in verse 21, after they had proclaimed the gospel to that city. Now, again, remember the last time they did that in Lystra, it cost him, right? He was stoned. Now, last time I preached the gospel, I got stoned. So, right, the temptation is then, maybe I'm going to cut back. Maybe I don't want to be as... I don't want people to be offended. I don't want people to come after me again. So I'll just be silent. Right? Those temptations are there. But he courageously communicates the gospel after he has, evangelized in Derby, and says, and has discipled many people, made many disciples. So they were faithful in their responsibilities, and then what does he do? He returns to Lystra. Again, we as human beings, we tend not to go back to places where we suffer, right? We try to avoid those things. But they courageously returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Pisidian Antioch. Now again, this is not because Paul is some stoic German, and he could just tough it out. It's not that, right? It's by the Spirit of God, right? He is enabled to go back to the very places that have cost him something. Right? You think about that. Going back to the very people who followed him to Lystra in order to stone him. Okay. So ponder that. So his first thing is to return to those cities after he has spent time in Derby evangelizing. By the way, the expression proclaiming the gospel is just that, we've talked about this before, but let me just refresh your memory on this. So you, I should probably do this in English for you. So you can see in this Greek word that's used here, euangelizo, we obviously get our English word evangelize, evangelical, or the gospel, as some call the evangel, right? So it means to, it's to proclaim the good news, right? Which is the gospel is good news, right? Now, any euangelistes, an evangelist, right, at all is associated with this. Sometimes it's translated in some Bibles with the English word preach. Okay. Now, I'm of the persuasion that biblical preaching is always communicating the gospel. But not everything a pastor communicates is the gospel. So the pastor does not always preach, right? When there's an unsaved audience that needs to hear the gospel, he is preaching. Otherwise, normally, he is teaching. So there is teaching and preaching. However, if you live in the South of the United States, right, every pastor is a preacher. In fact, I remember as we traveled for the college back in another century, but when we were down South, and if you were standing with the pastor, and people would come up and say, "Hey, preacher," right? That's just how they identified him. See? And in some people's minds, that's a badge of honor. And I'd say, well, it's nice. I just don't think it's fully biblical, right? I think we need to be careful what terms, and Luke uses specific terms, and we need to acknowledge those. So he evangelizes in Derby and he disciples many people. Now, again, making disciples does not necessarily mean that people became believers, right? John chapter 6 tells us very clearly that many disciples of Jesus got upset with his teaching in John 6 and followed him no longer, right? So you can be a disciple without being a believer. But you cannot be a believer without being a disciple, okay? And I think, not just my experience, but I've talked with enough pastors and over the years, I think a lot of our churches are filled with unbelieving disciples, okay? And we need to recognize that just because somebody is a learner, which is what disciple means, does not mean that they have trusted Christ. I think John 6 is a key passage on that. So first of all, they courageously returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Pisidian Antioch, again, which The Antioch there in verse 21 has to be the Antioch of Asia Minor and not the Antioch in Syria, right? So that's why I've typed in there Pisidian Antioch. And secondly, what do they do? The way Luke records this in the original language. Secondly, he is faithfully strengthening the disciples in Lystra, Iconium, and Pisidian Antioch. So not only does he show up, he also spends time there. It's one thing, well, I'll just spend the night. Now, this is more than spending the night. This is, I'm going to spend time and I'm going to do what I can by the grace of God to, well, as it says here, how does Luke describe the strengthening the disciples? Do you see it? Encouraging them to continue in the faith, right? That's part of how you strengthen disciples. Be faithful. Now, again, he is this object lesson. Maybe his sores, his wounds have healed by this time. The scars are still there, right? And these are the people who have seen or at least heard that he was stoned not that long ago. And here is this guy with the sores, perhaps still some bandages, perhaps still with an arm in a splint type of a understand. And they look at him and they hear him saying to them, persevere in the faith. Oh, okay. That has a different, right? A different impact rather than somebody who stands in front of you with a $3,000 suit and $1,500 shoes, right? So to speak. I understand that's a thing with pastors. So, but my point is this. Here's a guy who has suffered for Christ. And he's telling me, persevere. See? Wow. Encouraging them to continue in the faith, saying, through many afflictions we must enter the kingdom of God. Wow. What do you mean by afflictions, Paul? Yeah, see this one? All right? And all you have to do is look at him. All you have to do is listen to the stories shared by Barnabas and others who are with them. The point is they transparently encourage them to persevere in the faith, reminding them that we enter the kingdom of God through many pressures. So notice, by the way, the kingdom is still viewed as something future. This is huge. This one phrase here in Luke's account for Theophilus, to me, it helps settle the whole issue regarding the kingdom as far as amillennialism or premillennialism or postmillennialism. Right? Paul is saying, we aren't there yet. The kingdom is not yet. So we have to go through these afflictions and pressures, and as we persevere through these, then in the future we will enter the kingdom. So, and thirdly, the third thing that he does. So having courageously returned and faithfully strengthened them, he confidently commends the church leaders to the Lord. It says in verse 23, and when they had appointed elders for them in every church. Now, the whole church government issue hinges, at least in Luke's record here, is how do you interpret this word? This word simply means, the word for appoint there simply means to stretch out the hand. Now, are you stretching it out horizontally, or are you stretching it out vertically? In other words, are you being appointed? Are you being designated for it, or are you being voted for? Okay. Understand the distinction there. Now, again, we're in a culture where both meanings are visible. Right, in their society. The Greeks were very much a democratic, a rule of the people type of a thing, and they would vote. The Romans exercised a little more authority in appointment. The Jews also were a bit more in the horizontal instead of the vertical manner of stretching out the hand. So, who does the appointing here? To me, based upon the structure of this paragraph, Luke has been saying they, Paul and Barnabas, courageously returned. They faithfully strengthened the disciples. They, so who is the they, the third they? Does that make sense? Okay. So to me, it's just there's a consistency, and it would lead to Paul and Barnabas pointing out elders. You're going to be an elder. Okay, rather than a democratic vote. Now, I know I was trained in college and seminary to interpret this as being a vertical stretching out of the hand, because as Baptists, we tend to prefer the democratic version of it rather than the authoritative form of it. I'm not opposed to the Apostle Paul saying, you're going to be an elder. You're going to be an elder, right? Because he's an apostle. He has, by the grace of God, the knowledge, and if he has the ability at times to ascertain people's motives, and he does, right? Why can he not have a certain amount of knowledge to be able to know who will function well as an elder? At the same time, I don't think this is an authoritarian way. It's certainly authoritative. But there's a difference between being authoritative and being authoritarian, right? Authoritarian is negative, right? As parents, you are authoritative. You ought not to be authoritarian, right? There's a difference. Right? A husband is the head of his wife. There's authority. He's authoritative. Doesn't mean he is authoritarian. Right? So, I think here we have, based upon Luke's organization of this in the original language, I think he's referencing Paul and Barnabas. Notice it's they made the decision after they had prayed with fasting. So it's not just Paul. I think it's Paul and Barnabas, right? They're a ministry team making this decision. Now, at the same time, I realize that flies in the face of those religious groups that like to be more democratic. I don't think it's, and we've talked of this before, the church is elder-led, not elder-ruled, right? That's a huge difference. Again, there are some churches, and I have acquaintances in these types of churches, the congregation makes no decisions, right? And everything is decided by the elders, elder-ruled. And so you just go, oh, I see the elders made a decision, okay? And that includes choosing new elders, okay? So good or bad, right? But elder ruled is completely different than elder led. Elders need to exercise authority. That's the terms that Paul utilizes in 1 Timothy and Titus. He refers to them as elders. He refers to them as overseers, right? The episkopos, the Greek word for the one exercising authority over a working force. You can't be everybody's buddy at work, right? Somebody needs to exercise authority, right? So an overseer exercises that authority. The third term, shepherd or pastor, emphasizes the concern, but also the authority. The shepherd does not say to the sheep, how many of you want to go here? How many of you want to go to this pasture? Okay? We would say, well, that's ridiculous, that's silly. Well, it is. But my point is the shepherd exercises authority without being authoritarian, right? And there is that balance between, well, and then the writer of Hebrews uses the term leaders. A leader has to exercise authority without being authoritarian. Somebody needs to make the decisions as to where we're going, right? And Hebrews 13, the two times that word is used there to remind us that there is biblical church leadership. So let me pause there and see if you have any questions or comments. Right.
Yeah,
that's, it's a different situation entirely. And it doesn't mean that as pastors that we are apostles, we don't know what's in the heart of people. Paul apparently did, somehow. Peter did, right? We've seen that. They knew what was in someone's heart. You and I can't do that. So I think there is that recognition of there are things the apostles did that you and I cannot and should not do, right? Just because Paul, for instance, in chapter 14, Paul heals the man at Lystra who had been lame from his mother's womb. Yeah, you're not going to do that. You shouldn't look to do that, right? There's nothing in the New Testament at all that says every believer will go out healing everybody they come in contact with, right? So there are things that they do. There are things that, and I think this is one of them, the appointing of the elders for them in every church. You're talking about people who have been believers for a matter of weeks, maybe months, maybe? And how would they even know who to pick, right? If it's a congregational vote here. So you have, and I mean this nicely, but infantile believers making a huge decision, right? I don't think the Apostle Paul would leave such a huge responsibility up to people to... What is a church anyway? What is a pastor? What is an elder? What do they do, right? You're in an environment in modern Western Turkey. What does a church look like, right? What's a pastor supposed to do, right? So why would you give up that responsibility to vote, so to speak, hold out the hand vertically to people who don't have a clue, right? Now, I realize there are some churches where that is still the case, but rule of thumb is as people have matured and developed, yeah, they are able to make wise decisions, right? So... I think what we have here is apostolic decision making that benefits the congregation, and then as they mature and develop, they can pick their own. Which is why then we get what? 1 Timothy and Titus and 1 Peter 5, right? So we get that information later so that churches can wisely make decisions. But at this point in the process of Christianity, you're all on the same level of ignorance and immaturity. So Paul, I think, by the Spirit of God, is enabled to know who it is. And he selects them, and they are, I think, given, it's not recorded here, but based upon the rest of the New Testament, I think some of these pastors, these elders are given, and congregational members as well, are given spiritual gifts in order to demonstrate what maturity looks like in that situation. And as time progresses, the need for those gifts passes away, and people can function in wisdom based upon the Spirit of God. So I think 1 Corinthians, that whole section, 12 through 14, I think is fits in here as well. So.